Part 4. Psychology. Diagnoses. A team of psychiatrists interviewed and analyzed Jeffrey Dahmer for over 60 hours combined, reporting their findings in court at the trial in January of 1992. The way that Dahmer presented himself seemed to cause mass confusion in the mental health sector, which adds to the intrigue that the world has with him, both then and now. Defense experts included Dr. Fred Berlin, Dr. Judith Becker, and Dr. Carl Wahlstrom, while the prosecution experts included Dr. Philip Resnick, Dr. Fred Fosdell, and Dr. Park Dietz. Court-appointed mental health professionals Dr. George Palermo and Dr. Samuel Friedman also offered their findings in court. Dr. Park Dietz, one of the top psychiatrists in the world who is known for his work on high-profile criminal cases, spent the most time with Dahmer, 18-plus hours, uncovering the most intimate and grisly details of this killer's mind. While theories and opinions varied, Dahmer was found legally sane, which is not the outcome he had hoped for. He was collectively diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, BPD, schizotypal disorder, and a psychotic disorder, as well as having a sexual disorder not otherwise specified, alcohol dependence, necrophilia, and cannibalism. Some specialists argued that he was a sadistic psychopath, had elements of obsessive-compulsive disorder, and could possibly have been on the autism spectrum, more specifically, possibly having Asperger's syndrome. He was tested for psychopathy, but fell short of the cutoff score to be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, and was therefore not deemed to be a psychopath. In prison, he was treated for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, which highlights the confusion that can arise when mental health meets the law. This is an area that still needs a lot of work. Here is a brief overview of the definition and criteria for the diagnoses that Jeffrey Dahmer received, extracted from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5, by the American Psychiatric Association. Borderline Personality Disorder. Source: NIMH.nih.gov. Borderline personality disorder is an illness marked by an ongoing pattern of varying moods, self-image, and behavior. These symptoms often result in impulsive actions and problems in relationships. People with borderline personality disorder may experience intense episodes of anger, depression, and anxiety that can last from a few hours to a few days. They may experience mood swings and display uncertainty about how they see themselves and their role in the world. As a result, their interests and values can change quickly. People with borderline personality disorder also tend to view things in extremes, such as all good or all bad. Their opinions of other people can also change quickly. An individual who is seen as a friend one day may be considered an enemy or traitor the next. These shifting feelings can lead to intense and unstable relationships. Other signs or symptoms may include efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment, such as rapidly initiating intimate, physical, or emotional relationships, or cutting off communication with someone in anticipation of being abandoned. A pattern of intense and unstable relationships with family, friends, and loved ones, often swinging from extreme closeness and love, idealization, to extreme dislike or anger, devaluation. Distorted and unstable self-image or sense of self. Impulsive and often dangerous behaviors, such as spending sprees, unsafe sex, substance abuse, reckless driving, and binge eating. Please note, if these behaviors occur primarily during a period of elevated mood or energy, there may be signs of a mood disorder and not borderline personality disorder. Self-harming behavior, recurring thoughts of suicidal behaviors or threat, intense and highly changeable moods, with each episode lasting from a few hours to a few days, chronic feelings of emptiness, inappropriate intense anger or problems controlling anger, difficulty trusting, which is sometimes accompanied by irrational fear of other people's intentions, feelings of dissociation, such as feeling cut off from oneself, seeing oneself from outside one's body, or feelings of unreality. Not everyone with borderline personality disorder experiences every symptom. Some individuals experience only a few symptoms, while others have many. In Dharma's case, we can observe that he had experienced almost all of these symptoms in his life, right up until the day that he was murdered. Schizotypal personality disorder. Source: psychom.net. The signs of schizotypal personality disorder include three major components. The first is a decreased capacity to form close relationships, which can cause a person severe discomfort. The second is experiencing distortions in one's thinking or perceiving of events. The third is exhibiting eccentric behavior. In younger people, schizotypal personality disorder may first manifest as attention problems, social anxiety, or interest in playing or working alone. Kids may struggle with being teased or bullied, which can further heighten social anxiety. To receive a diagnosis, a person must have experienced these signs by the time they reach early adulthood. A person must also have experienced five of the following symptoms: lack of close friends outside of immediate family, eccentric or unusual beliefs or mannerisms, beliefs in superpowers, i.e. telepathy or superstitions, excessive social anxiety associated with paranoid fears, paranoid thoughts or doubts about others' loyalty, interpreting harmless events as having a personal meaning, dressing in an unkempt or odd manner, sensing an absent person is present, strange or rambling speech patterns, flat or limited emotional responses. Jeffrey Dahmer exhibited many of these criteria, including the collection of his victims' skulls and bones with a belief that he would be receiving power from doing so, as well as consuming his victims' flesh so that he could permanently possess them. Sexual disorders or paraphilia. For Jeffrey Dahmer, these included pedophilia, sexual focus on children, hebephilia, sexual focus on adolescents, necrophilia, sexual focus on corpses, and cannibalism, sexual focus on consuming parts of people. His sexual disorders would be categorized as paraphilia, which denotes any intense and persistent sexual interest other than sexual interest in genital stimulation or preparatory fondling with phenotypically normal, physically mature, consenting human partners. Brief psychosis or psychotic disorder. Psychotic disorder would be referred to as brief psychosis in the current DSM, which is a diagnosis given usually to a patient when psychologists or psychiatrists are unsure whether a form of psychosis will develop into schizophrenia or other psychotic disorders. After an episode of brief psychosis, the individual would usually go back into the state they were in before it, which is a behavior that Dahmer seemed to display. Tracy Edwards described how Dahmer would go in and out of himself, which is essentially how he managed to escape him. Dr. Park Dietz. Dr. Park Dietz is considered one of the top 10 psychiatrists of all time, and is a consultant to the FBI. He is also one of the primary inspirations for the character Dr. Hannibal Lecter in the Thomas Harris book series, which is also a film series: The Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal, Red Dragon, Hannibal Rising. He has testified or consulted in some of the highest profile criminal cases in the United States, which includes the Unabomber, Joel Rifkin, Arthur Shawcross, John Hinckley Jr., Betty Broderick, and Jared Lee Launer, and the Beltway sniper attacks. After spending more than 18 hours with Jeff Dahmer, he explains some of the insights that he gained regarding his psychology. If he had a compulsion to kill, he would not have had to drink alcohol. He had to drink alcohol to overcome his inhibition, to do the crime which he would rather not do. Dahmer was sexually deviant but not insane. There was no force driving him to kill. There was merely a desire to spend more time with the victim. Jeffrey Dahmer admired tremendously his victims. He was choosing those he thought he had an approximation to Adonis. He wanted to find the most perfect male forms, and he was affectionate for at least that person as an object. And so to him, these were greatly valued objects. Now, he may have dehumanized them, as all offenders do to their victims, but it was not a matter of hatred. It was a matter of trying to keep with him that which he most wanted to have. The key for him was to find someone attractive to cuddle and fondle all night. Maybe there would be sex, but that was not the key. The key was the cuddling, the fondling, the warmth of their body, hearing their heart. In summary, Dahmer was introverted, but relied on superficial charm when he needed it. While he was able to keep a job for a while, he was impulsive and adventurous in his personal life, often being combative and antagonistic when his freedom or desire for pleasure was being threatened. When people met him, he was able to deceive them by appearing inviting and friendly, a skill he relied on to fool many people throughout his lifetime. While Dahmer expressed to the FBI that he did not enjoy the many hours spent with psychiatrists, he did establish a meaningful connection with Dr. Dietz, which was mutual. When Jeff was killed in prison, Dr. Dietz said, "I was sad. Maybe his dad and I were the only ones that were sad, but I was. I give people a lot of credit when they come forth with the whole truth." Why did he kill? The simple answer is, because he did not want anyone to leave him. This reasoning was at the core of Jeffrey Dahmer's murders, as bizarre as it sounds. His first murder in 1978 was an event triggered by 19-year-old Stephen Hicks wanting to leave. Dahmer had been fantasizing about picking up a hitchhiker for a long time before he met him, and he wanted his fantasy to be fulfilled. Hicks was not homosexual and did not reciprocate his efforts to bond or prolong his stay. Dahmer was likely hoping that Hicks would forget all about his concert and rather spend the night cuddling with him, but that was never going to happen. In response, Dahmer impulsively grabbed a barbell and hit him at the back of the head and then strangled him to death. He felt so exhilarated and aroused that he masturbated over his body before dragging it down to the crawl space beneath the house. Once he had integrated his fantasies of power and control over someone with the dead, there was no turning back for him. For years, he date-raped young men, masturbated with a mannequin, and tried to satisfy his urges with pornography and one-night stands. Once he had spent the night in a hotel room in 1987 and found Stephen Toomey dead beside him, he said that the desire took complete control over him, where something inside of him had snapped, and he could no longer resist his compulsions and urges. He became a dominating serial killer that would simulate scenes of bondage and total control before snuffing his victims out. Then, his ultimate fantasy would really begin, lasting for a few days before he discarded of their remains. In 1991, he came up with the idea of creating sex slaves or zombies, explaining the killing was a means to an end. That was the least satisfactory part. I did not enjoy doing that. That's why I tried to create living zombies with uric acid in the drill, but it never worked. No, the killing was not the objective. I just wanted to have the person under my complete control, not having to consider their wishes, being able to keep them there as long as I wanted. When his experiments did not work, he returned to drugging and strangling his victims with the new goal of creating a shrine out of their skulls. He held onto photographs of his victims and meticulously cleaned their skulls, sometimes also keeping their hands and genitals as mementos of the time they shared together. There certainly was a sentimental element to what Dahmer did, even though it was bizarre and grotesque in nature. Some psychologists have speculated that the trauma that he endured with his double hernia surgery when he was 4 years old, and the neglect he experienced throughout his childhood, were primary catalysts to his behavior as a serial killer. Did Dahmer feel remorse for his crimes? While he made a monotone statement in court expressing remorse, he told FBI detectives that he had only ever felt remorse for his first kill, which bothered and frustrated him. Once he had killed again, he no longer felt remorse and saw his victims as nothing more than objects for his own pleasure and sexual gratification. He did not see them as people with families who would miss them, and was completely selfish about the way he approached the whole process. He also said that if he were released, he would have simply resumed with killing because his sexual desire and urges were too strong to overcome. He did not ever see why he would have stopped and wished that he had never gotten caught. Childhood. Jeff Dahmer was born on the 21st of May 1960 at the Evangelical Deaconess Hospital in West Allis, Wisconsin, to 23-year-old Lionel Dahmer and 24-year-old Annette Joyce Flint. During her pregnancy, his mother was taking up to 26 types of pill a day to cope with depression, pain, anxiety, and seizures or a strange form of muscle rigidity from time to time. These medications included Valium, Equinil, barbiturates, morphine, hormones, and other sedatives, which she continued to take throughout her life, regularly suffering from panic attacks and having to be hospitalized for her mental instability. Lionel Dahmer said that she had become addicted to prescription medication, which also contributed to her manic outbursts and unstable moods. Once Jeff was born, his mother did not establish a secure attachment style with him, allegedly refusing to breastfeed him and generally busying herself with her own life and complex mind. His father was barely at home, immersing himself in his chemistry studies and thereafter his work, rather than dealing with his strained marriage at home. In interviews, Jeff said that he decided early on that he wasn't going to get married because he didn't want to go through anything like that, explaining that his childhood felt unstable and somber as his parents were always in conflict. He endured long periods of emotional neglect during childhood, suffering in silence, and finding ways to stimulate his own mind as his parents drifted apart. He also described feeling that he was the cause of their divorce, knowing that his mother's pregnancy was so difficult, and thinking that her behavior was his fault. This is a typical trauma pattern. As a toddler, Jeff loved wooden blocks, stuffed animals, and all sorts of sounds, being described by his father as sensory stimulated, textures, colors, auditory. From a young age, he showed a fascination with animals and was described by his father as a bright and loving child. He experienced several ear and throat infections, but was otherwise a very energetic child who liked to play outside. When he was 2, the family moved to Iowa, where Lionel worked on his PhD at Iowa State University. Jeff and his dad found an injured owl and decided to nurse it back to health together, which Lionel described as the happiest day in his son's life, where he saw his eyes gleaming with delight as the bird flew to freedom. When Jeff was 4, he had to undergo surgery for a double hernia in his groin area, known as an inguinal hernia. His father said that he noticed a behavior change following the operation, where his son withdrew into himself and was no longer the energized, playful child that he knew. At one point, he asked his parents if the doctors had removed his genitalia completely, telling them how much it hurt. He walked around like a little old man in his robe, complaining about hurting, his father said. It is interesting that he went on to remove the genitalia from his victims and preserve them in formaldehyde, sometimes even painting the skin in nude tones before putting them in jars. Dr. Judith Becker said, "This event in his life was of interest to me because often people who have paraphilia, a deviant sexual interest pattern, recall some sense of pain or injury to their body." Around the age of 4 or 5, Jeff watched his dad clearing animal bones from the crawl space under the house and enjoyed the sound that they made as they clanked into the metal bucket. His father was impressed that his son was developing an interest in science and let Jeff help him. "Like fiddlesticks," Jeff said, which Lionel found amusing at the time. When he was 6, the family moved to Doylestown, Ohio, where Jeff began first grade at Hazel Harvey Elementary School. He had a friend named Lee, and he seemed to like school, even though he was shy and felt somewhat inferior. One of his teachers mentioned that he felt neglected by his mother. He was so fond of one of his teachers that he took her a bowl of tadpoles that he had caught himself as a gift. When he had learned that she had passed them on to his friend Lee shortly afterward, Jeff snuck into his garage at night and killed them all with motor oil, heartbroken that she had done that. When he was 7, his brother was born, and his parents decided to give him the opportunity to name him in hopes that it would lift his spirits. He decided on David, but recalled that he felt little to no connection to him because of their significant age gap, and often felt even more overwhelmed by loneliness and neglect when his brother came into the picture. They moved into a new house, with his parents sleeping in separate bedrooms. Jeff and his dad planted a vegetable garden together, raised chickens and lambs, and watched Popeye together. He wrote his dad a card that read, "The squash and the pumpkins can never compare to the dad who has curly hair. This poem is from Jeff, and I love you to death." He had a dog as a pet named Frisky, who he loved very much too, but who was unable to join them when they moved from Iowa to Ohio. This saddened him deeply as he had lost his only companion. It could be one of the traumas that he experienced which triggered his sense of loss and abandonment in later life. When Jeff and his dad went fishing together, Lionel said that it seemed that his favorite part was cutting the fish open to see their insides, a telling sign of his morbid fascination with anatomy. By the time he was 8, they had moved once more to 4480 West Bath Road, Ohio, the infamous home where his first victim was murdered in 1978. He went to Bath Elementary School, but became more withdrawn with each move and isolated himself more as he got older. One of his teachers did everything to try to get him to interact with the other kids, but it just did not work, Lionel said during a Larry King interview. Jeff reflected, "Maybe I started shutting down to save myself from the pain of what was going on. It was effective. Ever since then, I've never been a really emotional person." Psychologists refer to this as dissociation, which is a common survival mechanism developed in children who experience trauma. Sometimes, this skill can be used to turn off any feelings of empathy, connection, or bonding with others, which is what Dahmer was able to do with those he chose to murder and memorialize. When Jeff was 10, after a chicken dinner, he asked his father what would happen if they bleached the bones. Lionel was once again impressed by his son's interest in science and showed him how to bleach and preserve animal bones, a skill that unfortunately Jeff used to discard of his victims in later life. After receiving a chemistry set, he turned his dad's tool shed into his own clubhouse, where he collected and dissected insects, preserving them in jars of formaldehyde. Upon finding dead cats and frogs, he decided to dissect them and impale them on trees in the forest. At one point, he picked up a beagle that had died on the road and severed its head, placed it on a stick, and put it on display on the outskirts of the forest for passers-by to see. At that stage, no one knew that he was responsible for it. but school friends reflected on it once Dharma was captured and talked about the incident. "I was trying to shock people," he said. One of his friends, Steve Lear, recalled how they used to play ghosts in the graveyard, and that he always found Jeff to be a little strange and slightly scary. Adolescence. Once he had started high school at Revere High School in Bath, Ohio, his fascination with roadkill had escalated to the point where he started collecting squirrels, rabbits, dogs, and raccoons as often as he could in the afternoon after school. He told one of his friends that he was curious to see how they fit together, which earned him the reputation as a weirdo in school. The forest became his escape from his tumultuous home, where his parents were at each other's throats all day. He used to take a stick and beat trees to release some rage, and experimented with dissection, stripping flesh off bones, and preserving the animals he found dead on the road. His brother recalled how he had made a pet cemetery in the backyard, which he found endearing because it honored animals that were struck by cars and forgotten. However, in hindsight, Jeff's behavior was taking a far more sinister turn at this early age already. In high school, Jeff played tennis, was part of the band, and did quite well in his academics. As puberty kicked in, he started experiencing arousal from his dissections and developed fantasies of having sex with corpses. Dr. Park Dietz said, "If I could make a public service announcement, it would be to not think about roadkill while you masturbate." He further explained the importance of puberty and what young boys are exposed to, something which can shape sexual desire and arousal significantly in later life. Jeff's fantasies traumatized him, which is why he started to drink heavily to numb them out. By the time he was 14, he was a closet homosexual and alcoholic, drinking anything he could get his hands on before, during, and after school. With his inhibitions reduced, Jeff started bleating like a sheep, faking seizures, and running down the hallway with his arms flapping, which earned him the reputation as the class clown. He became acquainted with a group of boys who called themselves the Dharma Fan Club, who sometimes paid him to harass and prank people even at the mall. Most of his antics were mimicking his mother, who was completely erratic and out of control at home, and was described as a needy hypochondriac. He used his deepest pain to create something funny, artistic, and attention-grabbing, which his peers enjoyed for their own entertainment. People mocked and teased him, something which he internalized and took ownership of as he transformed himself into an entertainer. At times, he chalked outlines of bodies at school as if a murder had happened there, which unsettled some of his peers. One afternoon, while fishing with his fan club, he heartlessly sliced open a fish, which horrified them. They had agreed to catch and release, and were shocked at Jeff's apathy towards a living creature. By 1977, his grades had declined, and his parents had decided to hire a private tutor. They went to see a marriage counselor, but the following year, Lionel had learnt of his wife's brief affair in September of 1977 and had moved out of the house filing for divorce. Once Joyce had full custody of her sons, she packed up her things and took Jeff's younger brother David with her as she moved back to Wisconsin. Jeff had just turned 18, so she said that he was no longer her responsibility. He felt abandoned and more neglected than ever, and drowned himself in alcohol and fantasies in his empty family home. He had no money, no food, and a broken refrigerator, but somehow managed to graduate high school and make it to his prom, even though he was slowly but surely falling apart. 3 weeks after graduating, he murdered Stephen Hicks and dismembered him in the crawl space under the house, putting into practice the skills that he had worked on for years. Flashbacks of the murder and his new height of arousal consumed him, which made him drink even more excessively. These experiences taint your life forever. even though you try to forget and move on, Jeff said. After the divorce was granted in August of 1978, his father returned to the house and was completely shocked to learn of Jeff's abandonment, noticing for the first time that his son was a heavy drinker. When he asked Jeff why he had not called him, he said, "Mom made me promise not to tell you." Lionel took him to AA meetings and counselors, but Jeff showed no interest in any of it, drowning his sorrows in bottles of hard liquor. His father had found a new wife, Sherry, who Jeff was fond of and accepted as his stepmother. She described him as very polite, even though she was concerned that he was getting arrested once or twice a year for disorderly conduct. She divulged in interviews that Jeff even pulled a gun out in a bar, which they pinned on his drunkenness and did not realize was the beginning of a very dark downward spiral. Adulthood. 1 month after his 18th birthday, Jeffrey Dahmer murdered his first victim, which set the tone for his adulthood. College was clearly not for him, which he showed by drinking himself into comatose states and flunking out after one term. By December of the same year, he was enlisted in the U.S. Army, where he was trained as a field medic. His life seemed to be back on track to normality and success. In his first year, he was a fit and healthy adult male, but with sinister secrets, which included masturbating in front of children in the park, raping and torturing his roommates, and escalating his alcohol dependence to a point where it was out of control. He was discharged from the army but decided to try and make it on his own in Miami, which meant getting a job and getting himself settled into a motel. It did not last. Within a year, he was sleeping on the beach to feed his need for booze and called his dad for help. At 21 years old, he was back in Bath, Ohio, and being arrested for drunk and disorderly conduct, taking little responsibility for his life. His father sent him off to live with his grandmother in West Allis, likely because he knew that his mother had the perfect balance of strict and nurturing, which could offer Jeff a new perspective. He enjoyed 3 cooked meals a day, did chores for her around the house, and attended church with her, which did seem to get his life back on track for almost 5 years. By 1985, he was bored of church and started studying the occult, which revived his homosexual and necrophiliac urges. He started visiting gay bathhouses and clubs, where he date-raped scores of men before he killed again in 1987. He enjoyed his adulthood to its fullest, watching striptease shows, visiting drag and gay bars, dancing, drinking, and having plenty of consensual and non-consensual sex with his lovers. He was known as quite a honey in the gay community, one bartender recalled. He lived off his grandmother and spent any money he made from the blood bank and chocolate factory to indulge in pleasure, which meant collecting pornography, signing up for premium memberships at gyms and bathhouses, paying cover charges at Milwaukee's exclusive clubs, and drinking as much as he pleased. It also meant murdering 3 victims in the basement, dismembering and discarding them, and starting a collection of trophies, one which made it with him to work and to his final apartment. When he was asked to find his own apartment in 1988, he used his newfound independence to lure a 13-year-old Laotian boy home for a nude photo shoot and sexual activities on the same day, which he was criminally charged for. Whilst living at a correctional facility for 10 months, he managed to slip out for a one-night stand after spending Thanksgiving with his dad and grandmother, once again using a special opportunity to live out his fantasies. On May 13th, 1990, he moved into his own apartment, where he resumed his murder cycle within a week. By that time, he had transformed into the adult that he would always be known as, never wanting to change and never wanting to be caught. He murdered 12 people by the time he was captured in July of 1991, and in between his murders, he enjoyed multiple other sexual encounters with willing participants. In an interview with the FBI, he said that he shaved everything on his body to look younger, taking care to attract young, attractive males of bar age, which was sometimes a blurry line for him. No matter how you look at it, his adulthood was fueled by pleasure, unthinkable needs and desires, and dark ambition, all while sustaining a mediocre job at a chocolate factory where colleagues described him as just an average guy who kept to himself. While he appeared to have little drive and long-term goals, he certainly overachieved in the world that he had created for himself, calculating his every move to avoid being caught for over a decade. On July 22, 1991, he was finally captured and incarcerated, where everything he had done in the dark finally made it into the light for all the world to see. He was killed in prison 6 months after his 34th birthday, where he resumed the role of class clown in some way. He fashioned limbs out of prison food and used ketchup to make them look bloody. He taunted prison guards by whispering, "I bite," as he walked past them. And he once even put up a sign reading "Cannibals Anonymous" to poke fun at his status. His defense attorney, Gerald Boyle, said, "Dahmer had a death wish, and I know that he didn't have the gumption to do it himself, so I predicted the day would come when he would be killed in prison." Spirituality. Jeffrey Dahmer's father raised him in his Protestant faith, even though the family did not attend church or actively engage in it. When Dahmer moved in with his grandmother, who was also of the Protestant faith, at the end of 1981, he started attending church with her and decided that perhaps religion was a way to put his past behind him. Flashbacks of his homicides, Stephen Hicks and Stephen Toomey, plagued him, and urges of mutilation and homosexuality consumed him. So he decided to try to focus on the Bible, religion, and a straight and narrow way of life to overcome these problems. However, it did not work for long, and he decided to see if perhaps the occult would be more suited for him. After reading several books on Satanism and the occult, Dahmer decided that it was not for him after all, and chose to give in to his urges. He began to frequent bookstores to study more about the gay areas of Milwaukee, eventually putting his knowledge into action by visiting the bathhouses and gay bars in downtown Milwaukee. At this time, he said that he had decided that he was an atheist. When detectives questioned him about the shrine he was planning to build out of his victim's skeletons, he said that things were heading that way again, referring to Satanism and the occult. He said that he felt as evil as the devil himself, relating to being a condemned outcast just like Satan. He admired and related to characters in movies that represented the devil and started learning Latin to mimic them. "I was not part of any group but was reading a lot of literature on it and wondering whether it is possible to gain even more power through rituals and stuff. I didn't know, I was just experimenting," he said. He bought two griffin statues for his apartment, one with the word Leon on it, the other with the word April on it. To him, these represented personal power and meant that he did not have to answer to anyone. When he had Curtis Strauter in his apartment, the victim rolled off the bed after falling asleep, knocking the griffins off the black table that he had proudly displayed them on. He saw this as a warning sign that he was losing control and started fearing that he would someday be captured. He was right. He was arrested 4 months later. Once he was eventually captured, he told police, "I want you to understand that my questions regarding Satan and the devil were not to diffuse guilt from me and blame the devil for what I've done, because I realize what I've done is my guilt. But I have to question whether or not there's an evil force in the world, and whether or not I have been influenced by it. Although I'm not sure if there's a God or if there's a devil, I know that as of lately I've been doing a lot of thinking about both, and I have to wonder what has influenced me in my life." Once incarcerated in 1991, Dahmer once again turned to religion, starting by studying evolution, creation science, and eventually converting to Christianity. He even got baptized in prison by Minister Roy Ratcliffe in May of 1994. He said that he did not believe in reincarnation and believed that Jesus Christ could forgive all sinners, of which he considered himself one of the worst. Roy Ratcliffe became close to Dharma and felt that the prison guards mistreated him, even handcuffing his dead body, which was protocol. He received a handwritten Thanksgiving card from him 1 week prior to learning of his sudden death and felt devastated by the news, saying that meeting him had changed his life forever. He was inspired to continue to visit prisons after Jeff's death, knowing that he had an impact on him during their time together. Sexuality and fantasies. FBI agents interviewed Dharma for behavioral science purposes, where he revealed to them that he knew that he was a homosexual from approximately age 13. His first consensual sexual experience was with a boy in the neighborhood, Eric Tyson, who was 2 years younger than him. The pair experimented with kissing, rubbing, and touching each other's bodies, which Dharma said was just some heavy petting. They eventually stopped for fear of being caught, because homosexuality was considered the ultimate taboo in rural Bath, Ohio, according to Dharma. This was likely an appropriate fear, both in the community and in his conservative home. His father did not accept his son's sexual orientation, not even after Jeff died in prison, saying that if he had opened up to him about it at any stage of his life, he would have sought out counseling to correct his thinking. Jeff was ashamed of his sexuality, allegedly telling a pastor during the time in West Ellis with his grandmother that all these gays should have AIDS because it's a plague sent by God to punish them. One has to wonder what the outcome would have been had Jeff's homosexuality been accepted unconditionally by his family and peers. When he was 14, he started compulsively fantasizing about sex with a dead body, masturbating 3 to 4 times a day. He used alcohol to numb out his fantasies, which did not work. Out of curiosity, he started collecting roadkill in trash bags to dissect and study, finding himself aroused by the insides of dead animals. At his trial, top psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz explained that while Jeff's interest was paraphiliac, it is not uncommon for anyone to feel aroused by shiny things, especially during puberty. He also explained that Jeff's primary drive was to cuddle, kiss, and fondle someone who would stay with him all night without having any other needs or expectations. When he was 15, he told detectives that he got traumatized by a group of seniors who attacked him with a blackjack, a baton, one night when he was walking home from a friend's house. "And for no reason, you know, I didn't do anything to them. They were just looking for someone to hit," he said. He started fantasizing about retaliation, which increased his arousal for violence and necrophilia. This fantasy evolved into his desire to knock a jogger unconscious, which he planned to do with a baseball bat. When the jogger did not show up that day, Dharma never attempted to do it again. He fantasized about picking up a topless hitchhiker and taking complete control of him. When he spotted Stephen Hicks on the road in 1978, his fantasy became a reality, resulting in his first murder and real necrophiliac experience. After this event, he began to drink excessively, barely functioning at college, and the early stages of serving in the army. From 1979 to 1981, he raped and tortured his army roommate and another fellow soldier whenever he was drunk, additionally using homosexual pornographic magazines to masturbate heavily. He was caught masturbating in front of children on several occasions, an act which he continued to do until he was arrested for it in August of 1982. He told detectives that he had never been attracted to children. However, his father called in after the disappearance of Adam Walsh was broadcast on television and told police that he believed his son was not a murderer, but that he did believe he was a pedophile. In Miami, he worked 6 days a week and lived between a motel and the beach, numbing himself with alcohol. He visited some gay bars but told detectives that he did not pursue anyone sexually, as he did not find the opportunity to, neither did he have a suitable place to take them back to. Between 1982 and 1985, while living at his grandmother's house, Dharma tried to forget his past and live a more appropriate life, immersing himself in the Protestant faith with his grandmother. In the West Ellis Library in 1985, he received a note in his lap from a passerby who offered him sexual favors if he met him in the bathroom. While he turned down the opportunity, this re-aroused his fantasy to take complete physical control of somebody. He stole a mannequin from a department store and used it for masturbation, but once his grandmother discovered it, he was forced to get rid of it. A newspaper obituary of a 19-year-old boy in the winter of 1986 inspired a new idea. He attended the open casket funeral and said that he had the perfect body. After the burial, he visited the gravesite hoping to dig up his corpse and secretly enjoy him, but the ground was frozen solid, and he did not manage to dig his way to him and did not attempt it again. Jeff gave up on new ideas relatively easily, it seems. After reading more about the gay scene in Milwaukee, he signed up for memberships in several bathhouses, where he indulged in many sexual experiences and one-night stands. However, he was always turned off by too much movement of his dates during sexual encounters, and his urges to completely control them increased. To remedy the problem, he started date raping multiple men by putting sleeping pills in their drinks, which allowed him to enjoy their bodies without having to fulfill any of their desires or needs. He described this as a great relief. By the end of 1986, he was caught for these activities and banned from the establishments altogether, being forced to go back to the lifestyle of prowling gay bars for dates. On one occasion, he decided to rent a hotel room before going out for the night with the intention of bringing someone back with him. That ended up being Stephen Toomey, who he had fallen asleep next to and had evidently beaten to death sometime during the night. His psyche snapped and he saw himself as an uncontrollable killer after this incident. He stuffed Toomey in a suitcase, took a cab, and wheeled his body into his grandmother's house, where his necrophiliac fantasies took full form. Interestingly, sometime before murdering this second victim, he had rented and watched a real-life autopsy video titled Faces of Death, and had experienced exaggerated arousal from it, hoping to live out his fantasy someday. He drugged, killed, and dismembered three more victims while staying in the basement at his grandmother's house, trying to reason with his urges and impulses by studying Satanism and the occult. Once he had moved into his own apartment, he lured a 13-year-old boy home with him and was arrested for sexually harassing and drugging him. He said that he thought he was bar age and insisted that he was not attracted to children. Having read books about anatomy, Dharma was fascinated by the sounds that the human body made and studied the details while he dissected his victims. He was aroused by the viscera, internal organs, which he described as glistening, and enjoyed studying capillaries, muscles, and other parts of the human body as he peeled back the skin. Dr. Park Dietz explained, "There came a time when he found himself sexually excited by the appearance of glistening viscera of his victims. I would trace the origins of that very unusual paraphilia to childhood experiences in which at a time when other boys were masturbating to fantasies of the prettiest cheerleader in the school, Jeffrey Dahmer was having sexual arousal and masturbation while thinking accidentally or otherwise about the dissection of a fetal pig at school, about the dissection of dogs that he had found dead at the roadside, and that as he'd have such ideas enshrouded into his sexual fantasies, he inadvertently conditioned himself to become aroused to some of that imagery. While some psychiatrists describe Dharma as a sadist, he did not enjoy causing his victims any physical pain for sexual pleasure, rather drugging and strangling them before he explored their bodies. He told FBI agents that the necrophilia involved oral sex, penis to mouth, anal sex with a condom on, and that he made a slit in the body above the pubic line and then had sexual intercourse with it. When dismembering his victims, he slit open the body and masturbated on it, overwhelmed with arousal and sexual satisfaction. His ultimate desire was to have a human sex slave or zombie, which he tried to create by drilling holes into the skulls of some of his victims and injecting muriatic acid and or boiling water into them. He wanted to wipe out their consciousness while keeping them alive, but his experiments did not work and resulted in the death of these victims. Dr. Judith Becker said, "He felt himself to be a powerless person, powerless to attract people and powerless to keep people, so he thought that this would be one way to keep them under his control always." He started experimenting with cannibalism when he murdered Raymond Smith, Cash D, cooking and eating his heart, which he described as spongy. He told detectives that it made them feel like a part of him forever, and that it satisfied him sexually. He ate the liver, thigh muscle, and bicep of other victims, preparing his meals like a normal piece of meat, which he said was very tasty. He asked, "Ever had filet mignon?" "Yeah, it's like that, very tender." When asked if he was glad it was all over, he said that he was not, and that he really liked his lifestyle. He found it thrilling and exciting, and would have liked to carry on with it forever. He expressed that part of the fantasy was going out on the hunt, never knowing who he would meet, how nice looking they would be, and what fun he would have with them. Some have speculated that his lust was racially and hatefully driven, where he unleashed his rage and shame on certain demographics. However, he said that none of his crimes were racially driven, and that he was just looking for the best-looking people he could find with a perfect Chippendale-type body. Many of his victims were athletes, aspiring models, and good-looking young men. Movies, mentors, and other interests. Although Jeff Dahmer had a handful of favorite films, such as The Exorcist 3, Star Wars Return of the Jedi, and Hellbound Hellraiser 2, he told detectives that he felt power that his ideas and actions were out of his own mind and were not influenced by people, television, books, magazines, or movies. He said that he liked the idea that these ideas were his own and uniquely his own. Because he had always been and felt like a loner, he took pride in the world that he had created for himself and lost himself completely in it. At his trial, The Exorcist 3 became a focal point, as it was his favorite movie that he watched at least 2 to 3 times per week for about 6 months before he was caught. It was released in the USA in August 1990, and he paid more than $100 to have it in his possession. He resonated so much with the main antagonist, the Gemini Killer, that he bought yellow contact lenses to feel and look like him, often wearing them while he was prowling the bars to find his next victim. This movie was the only one in the series to associate serial murder with demonic possession, which appealed to Dahmer. FBI profiler Robert Ressler reasoned that Dahmer's interest in the movie was about the power the possessed had over the minds and bodies of the rest of the world, and over reality. Dahmer further explained that he, like the Gemini killer in the movie, could also create illusions. Star Wars Return of the Jedi, 1983, was also a favorite of his, where he felt particularly drawn to Emperor Palpatine. An ex-work colleague from the Ambrosia Chocolate Company said that while Dahmer mostly kept to himself, when he did talk, it was always about this movie. The evil Emperor Palpatine also wore yellow eye contact lenses and was appealing to Dahmer for his power over people. It inspired him to plan to build a shrine, which would feature his victims' skulls on a black table, incense on either side, blue hanging globes, and a black leather chair to sit at and feel more at home in. He felt that it would give him special, evil powers, and told detectives that had he not been caught, he would have completed his shrine within 6 months. Forensic psychiatrist Dr. Park Dietz said that his leather chair shrine was inspired by Darth Vader from Return of the Jedi. Dietz said that Dharma identified with the characters because he felt that he was thoroughly evil and corrupt. He used these films to get into the right mood before he went out to find a victim to kill and enjoy, hoping to be more like the characters that he looked up to so much. He explained, "I don't think it's abnormal for a child to have fantasies to zap his enemies. I think it's abnormal for a child to carry those into adulthood, though." He also had a special interest in jewelry, once buying a topaz ring for $1,500, eventually pawning it for approximately $150 to buy alcohol. When detectives questioned him about his visits to malls in Miami, he said that what he found most interesting was the high value of jewelry on display in the windows right there in the mall, saying that he saw a ruby brooch for $250,000 on a visit there. However, he did not keep any of the jewelry that his victims wore, choosing to discard it with their bodies in the trash. In the 6 months before he was caught, he developed a keen interest in aquariums and tropical fish, particularly brightly colored cichlid fish. He said that he was fascinated by their eyes, which looked almost human. His tank was found in immaculate condition, and his fish collection thrived in a creative and clean space. He was simultaneously caring for living creatures while taking the lives of innocent men, which is another fascinating example of Dharma's layered mind.